We have the privilege right now of, since we're hosted here at BYU, the dean of the business school, Ned Hill, is going to welcome us for a moment. And I saw a notice that in the Wall Street Journal that the school received the top placement in the United States for a regional business college by recruiters. So when they asked recruiters who was the best business college in the United States, for the regional group, BYU was picked number one, which I thought was outstanding. So we'll invite Ned to come up now and give us a welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here, and it's great to welcome you here. We've done this for many, many years, and we're always pleased and proud to be associated with the Taggart Symposium. You people represent something that's very, very important, the protection of families. We commend you for what you're doing. And we know it's hard also. Now, we have one of our sons was actually an insurance agent for one summer. He decided to try his hand at it. And he found out it was very difficult. He was very well trained. The company that he worked for trained him extremely well. He sold three policies during the summer, one of them to himself, and two of them were turned down by the underwriters. So it was a very learning experience for him. But he came away from that with a great appreciation for the protection it provided. And now he and his wife and four little children are well protected because of that summer. And he knows how to manage his money, and he's doing a great job. So we appreciate what you do. That's one point I want to make. Thanks for the great job that you're doing. And it's a hard job. We know it is. Number two is I want you to know that I'm a finance professor as well as being dean. I haven't taught for a little while because I'm in administering, but I used to teach finance and I taught insurance. And I have a whole life policy, and I have a term policy, several of them, and I have investments. I think that what you're doing is providing for the financial future of families. And you can quote me that the dean of the Marriott School of Management has a whole life policy. So I want you to know that that's contrary to what you may have heard some of my colleagues say, that they avoid such things. I see this as all part of a combined portfolio of protection for my family. Another point I want to make is that you're meeting on a campus and in conjunction with a school of management that is all about integrity. We try above all else. We want our students to learn how to be great MBAs, great accountants, great information systems people, public administrators, and so on. And we teach them very, very well so they can stand alongside anybody in the whole country and do their jobs very well. We also spend a lot of time talking about integrity and ethical issues. And the longer I live, the more I'm convinced that ethical behavior is at the core of any successful life. It may not be the best in the short run, but in the long run, it's by far the best way to go. We are in an industry, if I can count myself among you, being on the board of directors of a life insurance company, we are in an industry that is based on integrity, and that has many, many challenges to act otherwise because we are selling products that are very sophisticated and difficult to understand sometimes, and we are selling them to people who need them but don't know a lot about finance. We assume people learn about finance and they know how to handle risk and they conceive of the future and they know about interest rates, they know about risks and opportunity costs and so on. They don't. They don't. And so we have to teach them. And the temptation is to sell them something that we want to sell them. But as it was offered in our prayer this morning, our person who prayed said, we pray that we'll be able to help the people that we work with, and words to this effect, that we will help them with what's best for them, what's best for the families that we're working with. So please, please, whatever you do, be people of the utmost integrity. That will give you the best results in the long run and enable you to sleep really well at night. So I notice there's a whole track on integrity. What a wonderful program you have outlined for yourselves here that all of the people on the committee have put together. I got to have dinner with many of your presenters last night and got to see the program. And, boy, you're in for a real treat. There are just some marvelous things that are going on. And while you're here on campus, I hope, especially if you haven't been here before, if you haven't been here in the last few months, you ought to at least go see the Gordon B. Hinckley Alumni and Visitor Center. It's our newest building on campus. It was just completed, just really opened a few weeks ago. It's the one with the great big clock tower on it, just southwest of the Marriott Center. And they have, it's one of the most beautiful buildings on the inside I've ever seen, and on the outside too. So take advantage of being here on this beautiful, well-maintained campus. We have something like 32,000 students here at BYU. They're wonderful students. We fully realize that most of us on the faculty and administration could not get into our own school if we were to apply again. And these are really bright, capable kids. They're wonderful. Many of you have children who are here or grandchildren, and some of them might make really good people in your industry as well. So welcome to BYU. We're glad to have you here, and have a wonderful 2 days. You're in for a real treat. Thank you.
Thank you, Ned. Most of you have had the experience of someone asking you, what do you do for a living? And we stand there thinking what wonderful thing we should have prepared, but we don't know what to specifically say to them. And if we say we're in the insurance business, we're a financial planner, immediately in their minds they come up with a stereotype that they think. And so today our first speaker is going to talk to us a little bit about how to concisely answer that question in a way that not only explains what we do, but is easy for a person to remember. And if the situation is right, causes them to want to know more. So please welcome Scott Nugent, Regional Vice President of Transamerica Capital.
Little mic test. Excellent. Well, I want to start off with a question. I'm going to give you a little exercise process here. How many of you have been asked, what do you do? You've answered the question, and you've gotten a blank stare. You've had that opportunity to tell them exactly what you want them to know about you and your uniqueness, yet they kind of do this. Okay, that's great. In fact, I had the same experience when we had some of the hurricanes down in Dallas where I used to live. My father-in-law knows I work for Transamerica, and I do presentations in front of large groups. So when he introduced me to a fellow family member, he said, this is Scott, my son-in-law. He sells insurance to large groups. No, that's not what I do. That's not what I want you to know about me. But he's the father-in-law. I'm not going to try and correct him. We'll just leave it at that. But the elevator speech was designed to help answer that question, what do you do? It incorporates three things. The first of which is psychic real estate. The second, scripting. And the third, tonality. But before we do that, we want to talk about the words we use. In fact, Mark Twain once said, the difference between the right word and almost the right word is the difference between lightning and a lightning bug. Think about that for a minute. What pictures come to your mind when we say lightning and then lightning bug? What we want to do is make sure we're conveying the right pictures when we're talking to somebody. If I say the words plop, plop, fizz, fizz, there we go. Thank you. That commercial has not been on the air for over 10 years. But we're thinking of what? Alka-Seltzer. And in fact, all of us in our mind's eye right now can picture two tablets dropping in the water, fizzing up, maybe holding it to our face, a little effervescence. We have all captured psychic real estate right now. That's what we're talking about. It's the words, the feelings, the pictures that come to our mind based on the words that people use. Who owns the psychic real estate for hamburgers? McDonald's. We're not saying they're the best, but they own it. Who owns it for copiers? Xerox does, yet we all got HPs in our office. Who owns it for cola? Coke does. In fact, if you live in Texas, everything's a Coke. What kind of Coke you want? I'll take a root beer. Everything's a Coke. You come up north, it's a little more pop. Well, west, a little more soda. Who owns it for online books? Amazon. And who is the fourth largest online bookseller? Who cares? Amazon's not even number, they're not even the largest anymore, but they own that psychic real estate. Let's talk about scripting. Now, I'm willing to bet that every single one of you, that when you started the business, you were given some sort of script, weren't you? And what don't we like about scripting? What's the problem with scripting? It's canned. It sounds like a script. In fact, many of us every single day come home right about 7, 8 o'clock. What do we get? Hello, Mr. Nugent. I am not selling anything. If you please give me a couple minutes of your time, click. They're reading a script, aren't they? And even though we were given a script, the words to say, we don't like them because why? They're not your words. So what we're going to do is help you develop a script, but more importantly, give you the right words to use in that script. I need a volunteer. I'm sorry, what's your name? Cindy, what's one of your favorite movies? Not the favorite, we don't want to pigeonhole you, but what's one of your favorites? Someone help her out. Born Ultimatum, great movie if you're sitting in the very back and you don't like the shaky camera. But at any point during those movies, did we say, boy, that Matt Damon, he sure knows his script real well. He sure reads those lines well. No. In fact, those same actors that we give awards to, what do they need to say thank you? I don't want to forget anybody. There's only a couple I can think of, Tom Hanks, that got up there and sounded so eloquent. But what were they still using? A script. Something that they wrote, practiced, used. So we know scripts work. We just got to find the right one. Now, the power of tonality. We've got a little exercise here. In red, we want to emphasize a word differently. And this kind of goes to also email. If I read the first sentence, I did not say she broke the glass. What am I trying to communicate there? I didn't say it. But if I say, I did not say she broke the glass, what am I communicating there? I didn't say it. I inferred it. I implied it. I did not say she broke the glass. Now what am I saying? She didn't break it. She cracked it. She chipped it. The same words, the power of tonality, how we use those words is just as important as the words themselves. So how we use our words. So let's use some examples of scripts. And I had a great conversation this morning to help confirm this. But I walk into a retail, I got $40 burning a hole in my pocket. I'm going to buy a new shirt. I'm at Men's Warehouse. And I walk in, they say, hi, how can I help you? And with an 80% accuracy, we do what? No thanks, just looking. Oh, man, I want to buy something and I need some help. So I've got to either kill some time and get another person to come help me, or I got to finally go, can you help me, please? But we are in that automated response, aren't we? No thanks, I'm just looking. In fact, how many times have you caught yourself? So everyone's, you're coming into work. Hi, how are you? Fine. Hi, how are you? Fine. Hi, fine. Automated response. We get into those modes to where the buying opportunities are going right by because I come in. I work in the bank industry with some of my financial planners, and you'll be amazed that those clients, they come in, they want to cash their check, make their deposit. I don't want to hear anything else. Don't give me anything else. They want to dictate the appointment. Some scripts that work, though. At Nordstrom's, they do not say, hi, how can I help you? They say things like, is this your first time here? Do you know we're having a sale on the second floor? They get you out of that automated response. McDonald's, talked about them owning Psychic Real Estate for hamburgers. What do they say with every order? You want fries with that? What else? Want to supersize that? Have we ever said no? It works. In fact, if you go in there and order fries, guess what they're going to ask you? You want fries with that? It'll happen. Try it. When we don't use a script, we miss opportunities. We never know who we're talking with. We never know if that guy's got 50 grand or 5 million. The other thing is we lose the opportunity for our clients to remember our value proposition. If we say, I'm an insurance agent, I'm a securities guy, there was a movie out called The Pursuit of Happiness starring Will Smith. And in that movie, this is set in the 80s, the guy pulls up in front of the building in his Ferrari, and Will Smith says, I have two questions for you. What do you do, and how do you do it? And the guy's simple answer was what? I'm a stockbroker. He feed the meter. That answer was great back then, right? Stockbroker told you everything you wanted to know. What does a stockbroker imply now to our audience? You're one of those guys that drive a Ferrari, aren't you? We do not want that type of psychic real estate resonating with our clients. So let's get to the elevator speech. Again, designed to quickly captivate the attention of our audience and communicate exactly what we want them to understand about us. We need to pass the so what test. My first opportunity before I started learning about the elevator speech, I started at Jackson National. This is about 6-7 years ago. And when you're in the corporate job, you secretly yearn for that opportunity to be in that elevator with the boss, with the president, and say that one thing that's going to, you know what, next time I'm thinking of a promotion, Nugent, he's my guy. And I happen to be in the elevator. The head man's in the elevator holding a new computer he just picked up from the IT department. This was my elevator speech at the time. New computer. That was it. I blew my chance for him to say, hey, that's Scott Nugent over there. He had something good to say. And I came up with new computer. I kind of blew it. I want to talk to you about Floyd, an automotive consultant. Gary, what do you think an automotive consultant does?
Consults.
Consults? Excellent. What do you guys think?
Sells cars.
Sells cars, maybe even fixes cars. That's like a dressed up title we like. When I one of my first jobs I had when I first got married, I worked at a tanning salon. The great thing about working at a tanning salon, everyone that comes in there wants what I'm selling. It's just how much and how long. But I decided to dress up my title. I was an environmental light resource consultant. It made me sound like I went to school for this job. But Floyd's an automotive consultant. He's at a meeting where he has a chance to introduce himself. And he says this: do you know how most people don't like buying a new car? Because they don't like dealing with the salesperson. Well, what I do, for $295, I take you through a 15-point process to help you find just the right car. Then I go with you to the dealership to help you negotiate the best price. Tap on the shoulder. Can I get your card? Does Floyd sell cars? He doesn't, does he? Does he fix cars? This elevator speech is divided into two categories. The first is what we call an undeniable truth. What was Floyd's undeniable truth? Most people don't like buying a new car because they don't like dealing with a salesperson. In fact, when I said that, there was a sea of heads nodding in agreement. An undeniable truth is something that 98% of the public would agree with. So when someone asked what Floyd does, he didn't say, for $295, he said, do you know how most? And he inserted the concern that most of us may have. Part two is where we implant what we want the listener to know about us. And what was his? $295, 15-point process, help you find the car, go with your dealership to help negotiate the best price. I know exactly what Floyd is bringing to the table for my relationship, don't I? In fact, if I were to give a referral to a friend, which we all love, I could do what? I can say, hey, for $300, help find a process, 15 points, find your car and help you negotiate. Because Floyd was that concise and that specific in what he wanted to do. So as I said, we know that scripts work. We want to give you the outline for that script. So what we've done here, if you want to take just a couple notes, the first part is you insert the primary concern for your clients, your client base. And then we're going to insert the solution to that. So anybody know the number one concern according to the Wall Street Journal for retirees? Running out of money. So we would put that in line number one. Running out of money. Now all of us sell different things. We provide different services. We have different expertise. What solution is out there to provide to clients who are worried about running out of money? This is where we want to be careful. We do not want to say, I have a variable annuity to sell you. We don't want to insert the specific product. We want to insert the solution. So if I'm looking for something to help me with long-term or running out of money over my lifetime, what do I need? I need lifetime income, don't I? So we'd insert that into... So if you notice on the bottom, do you know how most people, or many people, are worried about running out of money at the time of retirement? Yes. Sea of heads, bobbing. Well, what I do is help my clients create a comprehensive financial plan to generate an income for the rest of their life. Oh, how do you do that? Oh, really? That is the type of response we are trying to generate. When we give a statement like that, that this is what you do, We want them to say, oh, really, how do you do that? Rarely will you see, I haven't seen it yet, for someone to say, okay, and walk away. It's not going to happen. So we have just put in there exactly what we want them to understand about their business. Because if they say, how do you do that? You say, well, I need to ask you a couple questions. You start the profiling process. You find out their needs. You help provide the solution. So very simple. So regardless of what niche you're in, you can insert that. My niche is in the bank environment. And some of the elevator speeches we've created, do you know how a bank is a place where most people think they just want to keep their money? Well, what we do here is follow a comprehensive plan to help you find answers to your retirement questions. Oh, really, how do you do that? There's a section out of Mark Magnacka's book, and Mark Magnacka is the author of The Elevator Speech, and we'll have these books on sale for $10. The proceeds are going to the Taggart Symposium. We'll also have some CDs for you. But in page 65, there's a quick little story that Mark shared. I want to read it to you. My client, a top-producing financial advisor, was going out to play a round of golf with a friend and had just been introduced to the other two members of his foursome, both business owners. As they were waiting for the bags to be brought around, one of the business owners said to the financial advisor, Frank, so what do you do? Frank said, do you know how most business owners have a CFO to help them manage their company's money? Yes. Well, what I do is work as a personal CFO for my clients to help them make work optional. So you can see that at that point, Frank communicated exactly what he wanted them to understand about his uniqueness. When the guy said, how do you do that? He said, tell you what, I'll give you my card. We'll get together and we'll talk about how I do that. And they went on and enjoyed the rest of the round of golf. The last thing we want to do is give a description about what we do and then have that lead to us just puking up all that and have them kind of going, I'm sorry I asked. We do not want that to happen. We want them to say, tell me more. Let me get your card. You're different than anyone else I've talked about. So that's one way we can do that. So as a reminder, we want to create the right psychic real estate when someone asks us what we do on the golf course, cocktail party, fireside, on the airplane. I tried this when I first heard Mark speak. I didn't know what to do after. Because my elevator speech, I'm a wholesaler. I mean, my title, regional vice president, I use that with the father-in-law. That's really the only time I try to say, you know, being a regional vice president is tough. But to many of you, I'm a wholesaler. But now when I communicate, when someone asks me, because I know on a plane, if I'm remotely chatty or kind, they're going to say, so what do you do? And I'll say something to the effect of, you know how most people are worried about running out of retirement income? Yes. Well, what I do is serve as a consultant to financial planners to help them find lifetime income. Oh, how do you do that? And my lead is now, oh, well, where do you bank? And then I'm able to generate a referral possibly to that. Before, I didn't know what to do after. I did my elevator speech and I kind of went, oh, I don't know how I do that. So it's something that we can't just whip off. We need to practice this. You need an elevator speech for every type of occasion. An opening to your presentation. Because very rarely will you get a client that comes into your office for the first time and the first thing they say is, what do you do? But we can take the elevator speech to position it. It's your value statement. You can start the conversation off by saying, do you know how most people, and insert the concern you think they may have. We want to demonstrate psychic real estate, scripting, tonality. Remember, all those are key importances in how we talk. So when you're asked, what do you do? I promise you, the temptation will be, and now you'll start thinking about it. Oh, how should I answer this? Should I just say, I sell insurance? And then the conversation's done. Or do I say, well, do you know? It's very tempting. I still slip up every once in a while. It's very tempting to say, I'll just pass on talking. I'm not in the mood. But if you say, do you know how, and get them to agree with you, then you're able to communicate exactly what you want them to understand about you. We had a really great clip. This was the closer. This was the clincher. An old candid camera where a guy standing in the elevator, the actors come in and face the other direction. By the time he gets to the next floor, he's facing the other direction with them. Thank you for laughing at it, because that's all I can show you. It's not running right now. But the one thing that I wanted to show you the clip for is we have the temptation to follow the crowd. There are many of us out there that are successful at what we do, yet we still struggle with answering just that simple question, what do you do? I know if you take some time to learn a little bit more about this and create your own psychic real estate, you'll notice a change in your business, a change in your clients and their understanding of you, And more importantly, your clients will now be able to communicate exactly what you do to their friends. Because that's what we want. That's where the money is. It's in the referral, isn't it? And how would you like them to say, oh, you need to talk with Scott Energy, he's a great insurance salesman. I mean, it's great that they say great. But I want them to say, hey, do you know Scott? He does this, and goes on about what I just said. I really appreciate the time to come talk to you today. I want to thank the Taggart Symposium for having us. If you have any questions, I'll be in the back, but more importantly, the books and CDs will be on sale for $10, and you can pick those up. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Scott. So we've invited a speaker to come to us today to talk to us about how do we break through these things. Our next speaker is the founder of and president of Strategic Breakthroughs. He is a leading expert in execution and implementation, and his process creates and focuses on critical factors that drive production and life balance. So please welcome Brian Moran.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Is this mic on? Is this one
hard to hear?
All right, let me just get set up here technologically. Great. Well, I appreciate being here with you today. It's my first time at the Taggart Symposium, and it's I'm excited about being here. Any seat will do. We saved one in the front row for you. But I'm hoping you're excited too. I'm gonna spend a little time with you this morning. I have some time this afternoon in a breakout as well, so I'm looking forward to that. Don't have a lot of time this morning, so I'm going to jump right into what I want to talk about this morning. And it has to do with, starts with really this question. And the question is, what are you capable of? And I wonder if you've ever stopped and really thought about that. If you've taken time to think about, what are you truly capable of? Because I have a couple assumptions as I'm here this morning. The first is that, as I look out over this group, this isn't a group that by and large is struggling. This is a group that's very successful. Fair assumption? The second assumption I have, though, is that you also feel like, most of you feel like you're capable of more. Or you wouldn't be here. Is that a fair assumption as well? Great. So think about for a moment, what would be different for you if you performed at your best each and every day? What would be different in your practice? What would be different in your relationships at business? What would be different in your personal relationships? What would be different with your confidence and your self-esteem if each and every day you performed at your best? So when I think about that question, that's the question that excites me. That's what gets me out of bed in the morning. That's what I do while I do. That's why I fly across the country and talk to folks like you. And as you start to ponder that question, I think it brings you to the next question then is, if you're capable of more, then what does it take to tap that? Right? So in other words, this morning we're going to look at two things. What am I capable of, and what does it take for me to be great? Now, if you're going to be great, and I think you'd admit Lance Armstrong found that. Lance Armstrong was able to perform at his best each and every day. If you're going to do that, what I can tell you is it's going to take some personal leadership. And someone once told me there's three kinds of leaders: those that make things happen, those that watch things happen, and those that don't know what happened, right? Hopefully you're not in the latter group. But I know for a fact that, you know, making the right things happen isn't always easy, is it, as a leader? Because just when I get things figured out, what happens? It changes, right? It changes. And I think Yogi Berra said it best when he said, you know, the future ain't what it used to be. The future ain't what it used to be. Because the world's changed, hasn't it? And it continues to change. Let me give you some names you might remember. Montgomery Wards. Anybody remember those guys? Penn Central. Gibson Greeting Cards. McAuliffe Chainsaws. I mean, I could keep going. Companies that at one time were top of their industry. Paragons in their industry that are gone today. Out of business. How does that happen? Right? In one decade alone, 233 of the Fortune 500 fell off the list. How does that happen? Because we don't change, right? We get stuck doing what we've always done. And in order to survive, we're going to need to change. In order to grow, we're going to change. But why is change so difficult? Why do you think that is? What keeps us from changing?
Habits,
the pain. Okay, the pain of what? The pain of change, right? The discomfort that comes along with changing the way we operate. If you're going to be great, you're going to make sacrifices. Do you agree with that? Do you think Lance Armstrong made sacrifices? I think the number one thing you sacrifice in order to be great is your comfort. The number one thing you sacrifice in order to be great is your comfort. And here's why. It deals with change. Right, there was an interesting article a number of years back in World News and Business Report that said from 1900 to 1960, knowledge doubled. So all the knowledge we accumulated in the course of mankind doubled in 60 years. I mean, think about that. That's phenomenal. It went on to say it's now doubling every 5 years. Right? Thank God for Google. But think about that. If that's even close to true, what is that telling you? What that says to me is there is no standing still. If I'm not pushing ahead, I'm falling behind. Might not feel like it in the moment, though. And that's the challenge. Right? The challenge is if I don't change today, does it show up in my results today? Typically not. Right? It might take years. It might take decades. And for a group like this, you know, all of us at one level realize to resist change is futile, yet we all do it too. And so for a group like this, it doesn't show up as outward resistance. It's very subtle. It's kind of waiting a little to see what the marketplace does. It's sitting back and seeing what happens with other people. It's not getting aboard. You know, I can guarantee you not everyone in Ward says, no, we're not doing that. I can guarantee you everyone in Penn Central didn't say, no, we're not going there. It was just slow to move. And in fact, I think sometimes the more successful we are, the more difficult it is to change. Do you agree with that? Why would that be true? It worked before, right? I mean, it's working. It's working. And change for the sake of change is not any good. You know, change isn't always better, but better is always different. I guarantee you that. And so sometimes the more successful we are, the more difficult it is to change. Let me give you another name, Sears. Right? When I was growing up, number one retailer in the world, bar none. They had the success formula. And here's what they said. If it ain't broke, what? Don't fix it. Yeah. So they dug in. Meanwhile, the world keeps changing. So they did. They had the perfect formula for about a day. And the very next day, the marketplace shifted just a little. Not enough to notice, but just a little. And the next day, it shifted a little more. And the next day, it shifted a little more. And they've been spending, for the last couple decades, they've tried to right that ship. And they're still struggling with it. So I believe at the heart of personal leadership is your willingness to change. Your willingness to be comfortable, if you will, with being uncomfortable. Because if you're going to perform at a higher level in your business or in your relationships, in your personal life, then you're going to have to do things differently and do different things, which means it's going to get uncomfortable, right? You're going to at times get out on the skinny branches. If you're going to move from where you are today to the next level, you're going to have to move through fear. You're going to have to move through uncertainty. You're going to have to move through discomfort. No way around it. Okay? So once you accept that as a given, then to me the question becomes, okay, what do you change? Because just like Sears at one time and Ward's, things are working for you guys. You're not at the bottom of the heap. You're not struggling. And wouldn't it be great if some things didn't change? If some things sort of stayed the same? Well, the good news is that what it takes to be great, what it takes to perform at a high level, is the same today as it was hundreds of years ago. It's going to be the same into the future. What it takes to perform at a high level is not some silver bullet. It's not some magical new idea. What it takes to perform at a high level is simple. It's steroids. It's all you need. A little steroid cream on your arm, shot in your booty, away you go. You're a winner. No, what it takes to be great is execution. Because in the end, you can have great ideas, but the ideas are only as good as your execution. Think about that. Top performers, whether businesses or individuals, don't necessarily have better ideas. In fact, our industry is great at sharing ideas. That's why you're here. You're going to spend 2 days getting all kinds of great new ideas. If you've ever been to MDRT, phenomenal event for great new ideas. The difference is not the idea. The difference is in the implementation. Top performers don't necessarily have better ideas. They simply implement more effectively. Because in the end, you can have great ideas. They're worthless unless they get implemented. The marketplace only rewards those ideas that get implemented. So think about that. The difference between an idea that's been implemented, is the difference between a flammagator and an iPod. Now, what's a flammagator? I don't know. It's never been implemented. But iPod did $3 billion in one quarter. $3 billion. Right? That's the power of implementation. So you can have lots of great ideas on how to generate more referrals and more openers, how to generate larger cases, how to create greater income, more free time. But in order to benefit from those ideas, you have to implement them. You have to bring them to execution. You have to bring them to fruition. So what I want to talk about this morning and later this afternoon in the breakout section is how to do that. I want to introduce you to a system that is designed to help you execute more effectively, to allow you to take your best ideas and profit from them. So the best ideas you hear over the next 2 days, take them back, implement them, and profit from them. And that system is called periodization. Now that's a strange word, so everybody say it with me, periodization. Very good. Some people think we made that word up. We wouldn't make up a word that difficult to pronounce. I had one lady come up to me at a session like this, said, periodization, that sounds like a gum disease. I thought, okay, floss and or you'll get gingivitis and periodization. But in fact, periodization began in athletics in the late 70s in Eastern Europe. And it's still used today extensively in athletics. So some of you, if you've been swimmers or runners, you may have been exposed to periodization in athletics. And what it does is a specific training regimen that focuses on one discipline or skill at a time and creates breakthrough performance. So when it moves through those disciplines in sequence, right? So I'll give you an example. A cyclist like Lance Armstrong, a typical routine for cycling would be Monday would be a light ride, Tuesday would be sprints, Wednesday would be hill climb, Thursday would be rope, kind of go like that through the week. With periodization, you take one of those disciplines, hill climbing, and you do it for 4 to 6 weeks every day. And then you'd move to the next skill in sequence. And what they find with that is it creates the capacity, greater capacity, physically and emotionally to perform at a higher level. When we looked at periodization, we said, you know what, this has applicability for business and in personal life. Because the fact of the matter is effective execution happens daily and weekly. And yet there's this notion that it happens monthly and quarterly and semi-annually. So we took periodization and really went beyond a basic training routine and created the concept for business. And if you haven't read this book, it's available. In fact, the breakout this afternoon that I'm doing, I think we've got about 50 of these, so the first 50 people come by, we'll give you a copy of it. But we tailored periodization to move beyond training to focus on the things that drive production and life balance. And at its core, periodization is a fundamental shift in the way you think and in the way you act. So we're talking this morning about getting results. Could be focused on business, can be in your personal life, wherever. But the question I have for you this morning is, what do you have to do to produce a result? At the most basic level, what do you have to do to produce any kind of result? Got to do some work, right? Got to take some action. Would you agree with that? Actions produce results, and every time you take an action, does it produce a result? It does, doesn't it? Now, it might not be what you want, but it produces something. All right? Then we ask the question, okay, why do you act the way you act? And if you're like me, your spouse asks you that quite often. Why do you do that? But what factors into the way we behave? Genetics, what else? Prior experience, great, what else? Beliefs, what else? Habits, what else? Environment, desires, goals, imprinting, education, training, all that stuff, right? All that stuff comes together to essentially form our thinking. Our thinking creates our actions create our results. Ultimately, our thinking creates our results. There's some thinking that's influencing the way we behave, and it's the thinking that says, for me to win, someone has to lose. Yeah. Now, I'm going to guess, this is a wild guess, but I'm going to guess you've heard this concept called win-win at some point in your life. Right? In fact, we've talked about it for decades, and at one level, we get it. But for a lot of us, there's this underlying thinking, if you will, that says, for me to win, someone has to lose. So we operate out of that. Now, not good or bad, not right or wrong, just an exercise, an example of how you can see how your thinking ultimately creates your results. Win-lose thinking for most of you that went into that with that created really a lose-lose scenario, wasn't it? 0 points. So what's critical here is we often focus on actions. And we say, just do this new action, it'll create a different result. This industry, referrals, is a great one. Build your business through referrals, it'll create a different result, which is true. Now, the challenge is that if the new action is incongruent with my current thinking, I won't stay in a state of incongruency. Typically revert back to the old action. And I think it was Maxwell Maltz says, if you do something for 21 days, it becomes habit. Well, you know, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't, right? We've all experienced that. Because unless the thinking shifts, it's not going to become habit. So sometimes we try these things, and then we revert back to the old action, and then we kind of beat ourselves up and say, geez, I'm just not disciplined. Yes, you are. You're disciplined in your current thinking. And when thinking shifts, everything changes. Breakthroughs happen at the thinking level. Periodization is a fundamental shift in the way we think, and then it's accompanied by new actions. So like so many things in life, it's not an either or, it's a both and. We open up some possibility around thinking, we support it with some new action, it further reinforces new thinking. So with periodization, one of the things we found as we worked with people to create the performance that they're capable of is that working with annual goals and annual plans was a barrier. So we got good results with that, and we broke them down quarterly, and we had monthly goals and weekly goals. We got good results. We didn't get what people were capable of. And the reason was is because something was kicking in that we call annualized thinking. Right? And part of annualized thinking, the first part of annualized thinking is this notion, this illusion that there's lots of time in the year. So think about this for a minute. January rolls around. I'm really excited about the new year. Got some big goals. I take off running. I get to the end of the month. I'm a little behind. I'm not happy with that, but I'm not really worried either. Why? Got 11 more months to catch up. Right? I get to the end of March. Still a little behind. Not pleased with that, but I'm not worried either, right? Why? Lots of time. 3 more quarters to catch up. And it goes on and on like that till somewhere around October, November. And all the while, I've got this trump card in my pocket called, the fourth quarter, when magical things happen. And in some cases, we pull it out. We hit the number, but it's at a cost, isn't it? Oftentimes, there's a lot of stress. We compromise family. And in the end, we leave all this capacity on the table. Now, there are some things that are positive that happen in an annual environment. I mean, those last 6 weeks are exciting, aren't they? Albeit a little stressful, they're exciting. I mean, it's a time where we tend to push aside all the non-revenue generating activities and we focus on the things that matter, the things that are going to help us hit the goal and make the conferences and make the trips. The challenge is it happens 6 weeks out of 52. The other nice thing, though, about an annual environment, one of the things that happens at the end of the year, is there's some excitement about a new year. Have you felt that? You know, as the year's coming to a close in the new year, you get a fresh start. So if you had a rough year, it's kind of like, okay, I kind of wipe the slate clean, I get to go again. If I've had a great year, I can build off of it. Again, the problem is, it happens, you know, once every 52 weeks. So the first thing that happens with periodization is we get out of that annual environment. And we really focus on 12 weeks as a year. We redefine the year. A year is no longer 12 months, it's 12 weeks. Now that may sound like semantics, right? You might say, hey, you're just calling a quarter a year. But if you really understand how we're wired, then everything changes. The power of the 12-week year, when you really embrace 12 weeks as the year in your thinking, everything changes. So gone is the unproductive thinking that I've got lots of time. Gone is annualized thinking. And if a year is now 12 weeks, then a quarter is a month is a week is a day. Brings a whole new significance even to that bathroom break. But that's where effective execution happens. Not in the bathroom, but daily and weekly. Right? And yet there's this tendency to think that it happens monthly and quarterly and semi-annually. That if I'm going to be great, it's sometime in the future. The truth of the matter is if you're going to be great, it's going to be right now. Because that's really all we have. We have this moment. 2 minutes ago is gone. 2 minutes from now is not here. Life is lived in the moment. And we're either great in the moment or we're not. It's not going to happen next month. It's not going to happen next year. In fact, there's a notion that, you know, you're great when your results reach a certain level. Our point of view is that is simply the evidence of your greatness. The confirmation of it. That you become great in the moment. And either way, the results are going to show that. So with the 12-week year, what happens is the illusion of lots of time is gone like that. If I'm going to be great, if I'm going to have a great 12-week year, how many bad weeks can I have? Not many, right? Maybe one, maybe. So with periodization, what happens is it creates a focus and an urgency on the things that matter most. And it's not just in your personal life, or not just in your business, it's in your personal life as well. You know? We have a lot of clients that use the concept to take new ground in their business and in their personal life every 12 weeks. So think about this. Think about all the things you could be doing in your business. And if you just focused on the one that would have the greatest impact over the next 12 weeks. Forget all the other things. Just do everything else the way you've been doing it. But if you're going to take new ground in one area, the one area that would have the greatest impact on your business, and you nailed that in the next 12 weeks, what would be different for you from that point forward? And you did that in a key relationship at home as well. And you did that maybe spiritually or whatever is important to you. But periodization is designed to help you take new ground in key areas every 12 weeks. And what it does is it focuses you on the things that you say matter most and creates clarity and urgency to do those things day in and day out when you might otherwise just push them off a day or two. But every time we push something off a day or two, we push off our future. We compromise living the life we want to live. And so periodization shines a light on that and says, if this is really important to you, and you said it was, then let's take action on it this day, this moment. That's the power of periodization. Now, periodization is more than just a 12-week year. There's a set of disciplines and principles that are fundamental to high performance that go along with it. And we don't have time this morning, so I'm going to talk about those in the breakout this afternoon. So if you're in, but I really want to encourage you, whether you attend the breakout or not, to give some thought to the whole notion of the 12-week year and the power it can have in your life to focus you on the things that you say matter most, to help you execute more effectively on the ideas, to take the new ground, right? To each and every day be performing at your best. Because the difference between mediocre and great on a daily, weekly basis is slim. But when you add that up over time, the compounding effect of that on results and on the kind of life you're leading is profound. So thank you for having me this morning. Have a great 2 days, and hopefully we'll see you this afternoon.